At Total Wine & More, find the best gifts for everyone on your list, whether it's a Cabernet for sis or a single barrel bourbon that dad will love. With the lowest prices for over 30 years, you'll always find what you love and love what you find. Only at Total Wine & More. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Drink responsibly. B21. Where can you find the best gifts at great low prices that everyone will love? At Total Wine & More, of course, with so many great bottles to choose from. Find something for everyone on your list, whether it's a Cabernet for your sis, sparkling wine for a coworker, or a single barrel bourbon for dad. And if you need any help, just ask one of their friendly guides for advice. With the lowest prices for over 30 years, you'll always find what you love and love what you find. Only at Total Wine & More. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Drink responsibly. B21.
Hi, I'm Kristen McGlory, lifelong genius hunter. Each week, I'm uncovering the recipes that will change the way you cook. This week, I'm speaking with Fall Esteem co-authors Sammy Tamimi and Tara Wigley. We discuss what it was like for Sammy, who hadn't been home to Palestine in nearly two decades, to both rediscover and reimagine the foods he grew up with, how Tara navigated cooking school with 18-month-old twins, and, of course, the genius red shakshuka from their book, where you don't have to worry about getting your eggs cooked just so. Hi, Sammy and Tara.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you so much for joining. I know you're both in two very different time zones from me, so thank you so much for that. Where are you both right now?
I am in Umbria in Italy at the moment, I'm here for the last 3 months.
I'm an hour behind Sammy in London, in England.
Got it. And how have you been spending your days? What sorts of things have you been doing since we're all sort of in various stages of lockdown?
I am in the middle of the countryside, so and I have quite a lot of friends around here. So just friends and taking it easy and cooking a lot, entertaining, which is really nice. Something that I couldn't do in London so much before we left.
Sammy's setup sounds slightly more sybaritic than mine. I'm at home with three kids, and so there's just lots of feeding going on, kind of rolling from meal to meal and dishwasher to dishwasher. But also, I think like lots of people kind of enjoying the simple life, the kind of removal of the complicated schedule and the sort of too many things going on. So just kind of leaning into to cooking and hanging out and trying not to destroy my family.
Yeah, no more commute.
Yeah. And it's funny because for us, you know, our book was due to be published on the day, sort of literally the day the bookshops closed. So on one hand, it was obviously sort of a blow for us in terms of the fun we were going to have publicising it together in real life and meeting people. But on the other hand, you know, it's a sort of cliche to say at this stage of lockdown, but it's then given lots of people the time they normally never have to kind of cook. And then there's just lots of things about the way that Palestinians cook in terms of kind of homely food and lots of pantry ingredients and just kind of day to day and meal to meal, which means that a lot of people have been cooking from Palestine and other books during lockdown. So,
well, to get to where we are with Palestine, how did you two first meet and how have you worked together over the years in the Ottolenghi family?
Tara, I've been with Ottolenghi now for 10 years. And when we kind of launched the Ottolenghi cookbook, Tara started working on this project. This is when we actually started working together because of the Ottolenghi test kitchen. And Tara worked also with Yotam in his own kitchen at home, developed recipes and all that. But yeah, only the last 3 or 4 years we've been working directly together.
Yeah, so before then, Sammy says, I've been in the test kitchen and he's been in the Ottolenghi kitchens. And I tried to hang out with him working for a couple of days in the Ottolenghi kitchen, but he quickly sent me on my way because realizing that I was more suited to the test kitchen vibe than the professional chef vibe, which is a very different kettle of fish, I quickly realized.
So how did Palestine come to be a cookbook? And, you know, was the vision for it very clear from the get-go, or has it kind of evolved over time in this intense process as you're talking about?
The idea started a long time ago. I mean, I had it in my kind of head for a long time because I left so many years, like 22 years now. And I always kind of had the Palestinian cooking and food as a kind of backup to my career. And I kept borrowing things to make it a little bit more interesting with the ingredients, with recipes that Mama used to cook. I felt like I needed to give a little bit back and also thank, you know, the place and the people and the wonderful food that they had, my family and my mom, of course. So the process started 4 years ago when me and Tara kind of sat down and said, okay, so what are we going to do? And I came with this 500 kind of recipe titles. We started with me kind of trying to be quite loyal to the traditions and recipes, but then quite quickly we realized that this is not what we wanted to do. We wanted to do something that people can actually cook on a weekday. It meant to be also for busy moms and families and people like Tara, where she had three kids and she doesn't have the time to spend 3 hours doing one dish.
I love recipe books because they all just tell such a different story, don't they? So all the books that are in the market, the Palestinian recipes, everyone's telling their own story, whether it's the story of the recipes that were handed down to them from their mothers and their grandmothers, or they're writing a recipe book for their children if they might be living outside of Palestine now. So this way to kind of preserve the legacy and tell the story. And then Palestine is very much the story that we were telling, which is kind of in part Sami's story and his love letter home to a country that he left over 20 years ago. But we also didn't want to tell just sort of not just Sami's story or even just one story, which is why we've got all these profiles in the book of different people in Palestine. And our way in was sort of telling lots of stories about lives being led today in Palestine. And this idea of kind of stories and recipes and narrative is constantly weaved throughout the book, as recipes in a way are stories. And also people allow for complexity and contradiction and paradox, and sort of just allows for the reality of that. So you can be someone who's really hopeful and enterprising and dynamic, doing really exciting things in a situation which is really hopeless and depressing and bleak. And these two things can coexist. So you can go to a refugee camp and acknowledge the reality of that and think about it and talk about it and ask questions. But then you can meet someone living and working and creating a cookery school in that same refugee camp and walk out feeling like you've met the most kind of sort of joyous person you've met in weeks. And shakshuka, for example, it's a story. Every time it's passed on from one person to the next, details change and some things remain and some things stay the same, but the essence will kind of hopefully be there. So without sort of labouring this metaphor too much, I think it is one that's kind of true. And the story that we're telling in Palestine is many stories about this life being lived today. You know, I think there's often people have nerves about their ignorance about a country and a region and a people. And you can get to a point in life where you sort of stop asking questions because you don't want to come across as the kind of idiot who doesn't know the difference between one place and another or sort of what's what. So I think it's kind of, we sort of reached out to hold people's hands. And I think they're kind of coming along, not only for the recipes, but also for the stories. And our hope is that people kind of go, you know, go with this book under your arm and go and meet people at the Tainted Nations, go and get a lesson from Islam, go and find Vivian. Like, these people are there living, working today. So once we're all kind of free to travel, that's the hope, is people go and explore and ask questions and eat.
Absolutely. It also really struck me that you mentioned including in some cases profiles in the book with views that you didn't necessarily agree with. How did you make that decision? Was there anyone that you didn't consider including because their views were so different from yours?
No, I mean, we met quite a lot of people, and the people that we chose to feature in the book, I mean, some of them became almost like friends. We loved the stories as well. And it kind of inspired us to, you know, because, you know, the harsh reality there and the kind of difficult living. But at the same time, these people are thriving and doing something positive. And many of them kind of do it with a big smile on. And it's kind of humbling in the same time, but also quite inspiring to see. It wasn't so much about agreeing with, you know, our vision, but, you know, we just wanted to feature people that we thought for readers to read the stories.
And also, who are we to judge? Like, you can't judge people who are living in a situation that you are living outside of. And we had these two great evenings where we hung out with two very different male restaurateurs, sort of chefs, and On the first evening, we were in Haifa with this kind of hip young guy who just was just a lot of fun, incredible food. But he absolutely wouldn't be drawn on any sort of political commentary. He wouldn't even say what he identified as in terms of being Palestinian or Palestinian Arabic. He just wasn't interested. He just said, it's just food, it's business, I've got a family, and he wouldn't be drawn. And then the next night we went to Nazareth and we had dinner with an older guy, Daha, and for him, food was nothing but politics from the minute we walked in to the hours later when we were finally allowed to leave. Everything was politics, from the music to the food we chose. And he had opinions on everyone. He'd be a divisive character. Some people might not sort of go back for their second meal there. But who are we to judge? You know, this guy is in his sort of 60s and he's been sitting there watching it, feeding it, sort of serving it for years. So, and they're both just approaching food and business and restaurant in a very different way, but they were sort of 20 miles away from each other. And he was quite scary though.
I love that juxtaposition and that you may not have been prepared for it after your previous evening.
Oh my goodness. Well, yeah, because we drank too much the night before because it was Sammy's partner's birthday. And then we all decided not to drink in the second night. And then we walked in and the first thing he said is, I hate it when people come to my restaurant and don't have a drink. Who goes out for dinner and doesn't have a drink? So we're like, okay, three beers. Crack on.
This is the Genius Recipe Tapes. We'll be right back.
The updates that you've made to the recipes, how did you decide what the right amount of updating was? Was that complicated for you?
How did we do? I mean, it's kind of, it happened organically in a way because, I mean, I grew up with Palestinian dishes where I know that they are delicious, but a lot of time the dish or the end result of the dish is kind of this beige or brown thing that, you know, you just put on a plate and you know it's delicious, but it doesn't look appealing. So we had to kind of emphasize on that and try to take some of the elements that goes into the dish, sometime, you know, adding other elements to the dish to make it a little bit more appealing, a little bit more complex as well. There are recipes that they're not purely Palestinian, but we wanted to try to do something that is a little bit new and fresh. Also, a lot of the Palestinian dishes take quite a lot of time to prepare and cook, and people don't really have the time. I mean, nowadays they do, but the idea is that, you know, you just come back from work after a long day and you just want to do something in 20 minutes.
But again, as with the words, like the sense of responsibility of kind of, you know, we have this section within next to our recipes called playing around and you know, if alternatives are suggested. But, you know, we know that actually it's not as simple as just playing around if the recipe is tied up with your identity. So we were very sort of aware of that. And so the ingredients, there's no kind of left field ingredients. And Sammy very much held the line. If ever I would sort of suggest that quinoa might work instead of bulgur wheat, for example, if someone was sort of gluten free, he was like, this is a book without quinoa because we do not have quinoa in Palestine. So yeah, and then also not wanting to include ingredients that people can't get hold of. So there's a traditional Palestinian dish called mansaf where lamb is cooked in this sort of fermented disc of yogurt called jami. You really can't get out of Palestine, outside Palestine, and we want the books to be very, very kind of practical and used by people.
I loved that you especially noted that the hummus that had been published first in the Jerusalem cookbook, that had not changed. I actually wrote about that recipe back when Jerusalem came out as a Genius recipe back in 2013 after some Food 52 community members raved about how life-changing it was. And I know that technique came from your grandmother, right, Sammy?
Yeah, I mean, there's no need to change such a recipe because it worked wonderfully. And it's, I mean, what I hear from people, it's one of the best hummus recipes. And yeah, the idea is not to change things totally. I mean, the topping changed, but that's kind of something that I would also do at home. If I do hummus, I would just do a different topping every time. We kept true and loyal to the tradition. And there's quite a lot of traditional recipes as well in Palestine. So for people that kind of start or they are not familiar with the Palestinian kitchen, there's there's everything for them in the book, from, you know, new to the very tradition. And yeah, I mean, it's just like, I was just talking to my sister the other day about the book, and it's like, you know, all the Palestinians know how to cook the dishes. I mean, you know, all these women that cook at home, they know already how to do them. They don't need a book. But she said it's actually nice that there are quite a lot of new recipes that she doesn't even know. And this is what Palestinians will be cooking, which is it's quite a sweet thing to say.
So, Sammy, I know that you have said that you were sort of shooed away from the kitchen as you were growing up. I'm curious, I have a lot of questions about that, actually. I mean, did that make you want to cook all the more? And then things like your grandmother's hummus technique, how did you learn that and incorporate it into your cooking later on?
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, the curiosity and the passion to know about cooking, and, you know, it was there the whole time since I was a little kid. And, you know, I did kind of sneak into the kitchen and be shushed out. And I actually didn't know that I wanted to be a chef until I was kind of 17 in a hotel. And yeah, and going back to the hummus recipe, this is what the Palestinians do wonderfully, where, you know, the hand, it's the tradition, it's also the cooking techniques, and also the way they preserve and they want to keep the recipes alive. So they hand them from one generation to another. So my mom basically inherited this kind of method of cooking hummus from my grandma, and it moves on to my sisters, and I also kind of borrowed it from the family. So it was already alive, and everybody's making it at home. I just have to basically take a step and just say, okay, this is going into the book.
Because all the cooking at home is done by women in Palestine, sort of when Sammy was growing up, but also today. And I just love, Sammy never says it himself, so I have to say it, but I think it's amazing that the person who's teaching the world to cook Palestinian food is a man, because it's really unusual. It's just a really rare thing. And then, so it's amazing to think of that little boy being just out the kitchen, that he's going to be the one who just teaches so many people how to cook Palestinian food at home. It's amazing. I'm so sad we haven't got any excuses anymore to travel to Palestine. The last kind of 5 years, I feel like I've been there every year. And in fact, we have a joke at home that whenever, because I left for Palestine one morning before one of my kids woke up, and he woke up and he's like, where's mum gone? And my husband said, oh, she's gone to Palestine. And he just thought I was going for a run. So now whenever I go for a run, I have to write a note saying, I'm going for a run, brackets, not to Palestine.
Of the many different ways that you gathered recipes for this book, where did this one come from?
This came actually from my family. We haven't had the shakshuka, the traditional shakshuka that you kind of see. It's a kind of scrambled eggs into onion and tomatoes. And actually, sometimes they call it egg and tomato. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's rooted probably from Turkey or from the Ottomans, where they do almost the same thing, but they add also butter on top. So yeah, shakshuka for me as a kid, it was scrambled eggs into tomato and onion. And we added other elements to it too. At home, we used ground spices, but the recipe asked for toasted whole spices and the feta as a different element and texture as well.
It's such a good example of one of the recipes in our book, because it's like, it's something that Sammy would have had as a child in a sort of simpler version without all the toppings, that he brings to the test kitchen with his kind of his memory and the technique. But then once it gets into the test kitchen, then we start kind of playing around. So that I think the evolution is so demonstrated by this recipe.
Yeah. And we actually started the list. We had three shakshukas, remember? We had yellow shakshuka, we had green shakshuka, and then the red shakshuka, I wanted to do, like, you know, the way I had it as a child, which is scrambled.
Well, and the thing that really drew me to the recipe at first is that obviously, like, a poached or braised shakshuka is theoretically very simple to make as well. But I think that some people are intimidated to get their eggs just right. They're worried about overcooking them or undercooking them, or maybe like some are over, some are under. And I happen to be one of them. So I was really drawn to the idea that with scrambling, you have that much more control. I'm curious if that crossed your mind at all when you were including it.
Yeah, and also, I mean, a lot of people also don't like very runny eggs. which is another kind of thing that I had in mind.
I'm a pathological recipe quadrupler. So I also love shakshukas, but particularly the red one, in that you can just quadruple the base, and then you've got a kind of supper in less than 5 minutes, because you can just add whatever you want to the pan and then and then slowly scramble your eggs through it.
And there's something about it too that's very gentle to scrambled eggs. I think it's very hard to overcook scrambled eggs when they have such a delicious.
Yes. I mean, the sauce does help it, and you know, kind of make it keep it moist for the whole time. Even when it cooled down. I mean, I remember I had some the next day, and it's still delicious to eat.
I was feeding it to my daughter the next day, and she didn't seem to mind. So I also enjoyed it. When are scrambled eggs good leftovers?
Yeah,
except for in this dish.
Completely.
I love it when people say that kids love them.
I took my kids to Sammy's house for lunch once. I was like, right, kids, the thing about Sammy, he's quite a good chef and quite a well-known cook. So whatever he puts in front of you, you gotta eat. They did.
Did that work?
Yeah. It did work. Yeah, it did work. Sammy was like, your kids are really well behaved. I was like, they were terrified.
Actually, speaking of kids, I saw when they were 18 months old, you went to cooking school and brought them along. And my daughter is 18 months right now, and I just have to, my hat is off to you.
I know. Well, my hat is off to myself as well. I don't know what I don't know what I was thinking. I mean, the things you do in the moment. And then I look back a few years later, and I was like, wow, that's pretty punchy. And I took this great big dog that we picked up in Bosnia, who is basically a wolf, and which we didn't realize until we brought her back to the UK. And I don't know if it's having twins just made me sort of negligent. And I just found this child mind you in the local village, and she charged about £4 a day per child. And she had this great big fish tank. And I think these kids just sat in front of this fish tank for about 3 months. And I have to say, looking back on it, I think that was a punchy move. But I don't know, I thought I turned up and everyone would be at cookery school with kind of families and husbands and dogs, and just everyone was completely by themselves, and either sort of 18 and fresh out of school, or sort of 60 and recently divorced and didn't know how to cook eggs, and I was just sort of bang in the middle. But yeah, sometimes you just gotta jump.
I find that so inspiring, because I mean, we had to jump in that we just moved cross country, but in elective ways, you know, I find myself trying to be like, wait, no, I don't know if we can do that, because I don't know if she can handle it and I don't know if I can handle it. And like, you have just proven, yes, like you can handle it, you'll figure it out.
Yeah, I think the logistics all work out somehow. I don't know, you can get kind of, with kids, kind of obsessed by logistics, and actually you just got to just plow on, and just everyone can just sort of run and catch up somehow.
Thank you for that. And thank you for sharing that story too, because it's for all of us other people who are just trying to make it work with young kids. It's quite inspiring.
Well, they're 12 next week. Everyone's made it to this age.
Amazing. Thank you both for spending a good chunk of your evening with me. I hope you have a lovely rest of your Sunday.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thanks for listening. Our show was put together by Coral Lee, Gabriella Mangino, Alik Barsoomian, Ayana Long, and me, Kristen McGlory. You can find all the Genius recipes, videos, and stories at our site, food52.com. And if you have a Genius recipe that you'd like to share, please email it to me at genius@food52.com. I am always hunting. If you like the Genius recipe tapes, be sure to rate and review us. It really helps. See you next time.